10 years ago, I got up in the morning, I read the LA Times and some other papers. I went out to the mailbox every day to see if Baseball America had arrived. Went down to the library and got out the microfilm and looked at the sporting news. When I had a question, I'd stand up and walk over to the bookshelf and pull down Total Baseball or Sporting News Guide or Sporting News Register and check something. So today, I get up in the morning and I read the LA Times. But then I'll check Baseball America online just to see what's new with them today. If I'm doing some research, I'll probably go to Paper of Record and read the sporting news there. At some time during the day when I'm pretending to be working, I'll go look at Fan Graphs and probably Baseball Perspectives and Hardball Times and Baseball Think Factory. And if I have a question or two about some fact I want to check, I will probably go to Baseball Reference. So in the past 10 years, as you can see, my habits have changed a great deal, and I suspect I'm pretty representative of what's going on in this room. So the first question we're going to ask the panel, start with Bill and move over, is what am I going to be doing 10 years from now? And what are all of you going to be doing 10 years from now? Bill?
Thanks, Andy. So I think that I'm going to answer this with a little bit more of a mass audience perspective and a little bit more of the kind of broader baseball universe, because I think certainly from Bloomberg's perspective, we're actually trying to bridge a bunch of things with a lot of the analysis and data visualization and work we're doing with the technology that Bloomberg's developed over the years for the financial services market, where we're able to do the kinds of things that will be particularly unusual and hopefully really helpful and fascinating to people in this room. But we also, as part of growing a large business, we have our eye on a much broader market as well. And so when we think about what is it that will happen over the course of the next 10 years to change the way in which baseball fans broadly will receive information, we really think about all of the different changing platforms. And I would agree with you in one important respect, which is that I think to get a sense of how dramatically things are likely to change in the way that you get your information, the best way to do that is to begin by looking backwards, because it's very easy to fall into that trap of thinking about incremental change. But when you do look over your shoulder and you realize how monumentally things have changed in media broadly over the past, let's say, 30 years even, it's really extraordinary. And therefore, as you look forward 10 years, you can make some educated guesses about directions. But I think if any of us are really being honest, we don't know yet what some of the developments are likely to be that will have a profound effect on the way that we consume information. And if you look back just 10 years, as you were saying, there was really no mobile data experience, and now you have smartphones outselling PCs, right? There really was, no such thing as, video other than through television. There was sort of choppy video in the early days as you began to get it on the internet. Now, people are experiencing video everywhere they are, everywhere they go, whenever they want to. And that's only going to become more prevalent. So I think that you really get perspective on what's likely to happen in large part by going back. And the main insight that you receive from that is that whatever you might imagine, we all grew up, watching the Jetsons and seeing things fly around and thinking about all these crazy futuristic things. But, it's certainly more than just a cliche that truth is stranger than fiction. And the kinds of things that we might even imagine, more likely than not, the way in which information media will change is going to outstrip that. So, as we look forward, we do certainly see some developments that you begin to recognize are likely to continue. The whole world of mobility, which gives people the ability to access anything, anytime, when it's convenient for them, is only going to increase. Right. So So whether that means notebook computers or mobile phones or combinations, that's something I think that we can count on. That you'd be able to really get what you want, where you want it, when you want it. It'll also be a whole environment where you can customize it. So if you have certain sources that you rely on as your sort of daily staple, you'll probably be in a position where you can designate those sources, you can have it on the device of your choice, you can roll out of bed in the morning, and it'll all be right there ready for you. Right? And then if you want to interact with it, the likelihood will be that with very easy navigation and user interfaces that are very well developed, you'll be able to pull out any additional information, any broader facts. All these things will be at your fingertips. The other thing, though, which I think people sometimes get away from, is that that doesn't mean we're going to depart entirely from the world of mass media, television, sort of broadly distributed information. There's always going to be particular writers, particular programming that as a mass we want to watch. And one of the reasons for that is purely the economics. You need to have a mass market to have funding that will invest in these sorts of things and then distribute it to people who want to consume them. So I think we'll certainly continue to have that, but it will be tied with all kinds of new technology. And so, you know, we've heard for many years about the converged devices where the internet and television and now mobility are all coming together. Sometimes these things actually take a few years longer than, you know, the dreamers put out there, but usually they come to pass. And you probably have now seen, if you've been to a Best Buy lately, that you really can't buy a television anymore. It's not internet ready. But what does that mean? As soon as you have it in your home and there's enough critical mass, what you will be able to do is interact with your television. So you'll be able to watch a game on one side and you'll be able to get the Sabre website on another, and, you know, a baseball reference site, and you'll be able to be researching things, you'll be able to be chatting with your friends. And of course, the one thing I haven't mentioned is the whole development of social media. I mean, nobody ever heard of Facebook 10 years ago because it really didn't exist. Now you have 700 million participants. Right? So it's going to change the way in which everybody interacts and distributes media. So, you know, we may all be, and certainly, you know, my generation, which is probably the generation of most of us in the room, very used to having media pushed at us. The generation coming up behind us is much more used to distributing information among themselves, and that's going to accelerate. So I just finished by sort of saying, you know, kind of telling one story. When I was, you know, a fairly young lawyer practicing in Washington, I was representing a lot of the new cellular telephone companies when cellular was first beginning to really get off the ground. And we were hearing in a state which was considering licensing cellular telephony. And we had these huge brick-like cellular phones that were showing it weighed about, you know, 15 pounds or something, barely lifted. And we were talking about what the impact would be on the public. And the lawyer representing the company stood up and said, because I was representing one of the participants in the hearing, the lawyer representing the company said, well, look, we shouldn't really be that concerned about how it will affect the general public, because these things are a luxury item, and only people that drive Mercedes will have them, and it will probably be a tiny percentage of the population. So you don't have to worry about mobile phones, because not really anybody's going to use them except this tiny little slice. So, and what he was actually echoing at the time was the broadly held conventional wisdom. So I would say, and I've always taken that over the years as sort of a cautionary tale, that whenever you hear from someone that, you know, don't worry, this is absolutely the way it's going to unfold, that's the first time that you should think, well, maybe it's not going to be that way. So, you know, I think we're going to see dramatic change over the next 10 years. And I think that the opportunities for individuals to get things when they want it, as they want it, are simply going to increase.
I agree wholeheartedly with pretty much all of that. I think anybody who tells you that they don't know what we're going to be in 10 years is probably not being very honest. And also to your point, if you look back at the last decade, just to sort of see what has the changes that have come down the pipe. Mike, in our industry, 3 years ago, Twitter wasn't even a major force in the marketplace, and now, you know, all of our sports writers and people who cover games are using it on a minutely basis, if you will. That's been a real interesting phenomenon. I think that two things seem fairly certain to me. One is that the move to electronics and a digital medium is only going to continue, and that the print side of that will probably continue to decline, which is something we were facing with and wrestling with in our business on an hourly basis, and trying to reposition for that future. It also seems very hard to me to understand how we're going to get information faster than we already are. I mean, you know, some of the folks up here who run websites, I get email and text alerts every time the Dodgers score a run. Not as many as are usually hearing out. That it seems hard to believe we'll be able to get information faster if you're like me and really up on, you want to be up on every game. Our website, ESPN, you know, and many others have those up to this pitch. So it seems like maybe what we're wanting going is that the speed, there may be some new mediums that can get it to us in different ways, but while we're trying to position ourselves at the LA Times just to make sure that we are going to be able to deliver that information to you in whatever form it is you consume it, which is why we've made some major strides both on the website and with Twitter and Facebook and what have you. The readers have more choices today than they've had at any point in history. There's more competitive material out there than there has been at any point in history, and there is more demand for what we do than at any point in history. So it's a really fascinating and exciting time to be in our business, and we're also trying to sort of figure out where the longer-term trends go. The last thing I would say is that, to the point about competition and expertise, we are trying to stake ourselves out in the areas that we would logically expect us to own, and obviously for this audience, we fancy ourselves as the resident experts on all things Dodgers and all things Angels, and we've added lots of features on our website. Some for the season, we're working on some that will exceed before the end of the season that will enhance that fan experience, and we have the largest reporting staffs that are covering both of those teams of anybody else that's out there. And so that's how we're positioning ourselves to be the experts, the continued experts on that front.
Let's see, I would just add two things. From my perspective, we're coming into an area where we're essentially coming into huge data sets. We, thanks to Revenue Share and other people, we have play-by-play accounts, which is on the order of about 200,000 plays per season. For instance, I have a play-by-play database that has about 1.8 billion cells. If you go back all the way to 1950, I have 180 columns for each of those plays. We're thanks to MLB, thanks to BAM, we have a million pitches per season. And coming down the line, we're going to have probably 2 to 3 billion data points per season just on defensive data. The new FieldFX that Sport Vision's working on, it is going to produce just a mountain, like a million rows per game. They're tracking each individual fielder for each tenth of a second, their position on the field and the location of the ball. So we'll be able to, without definitively tell you that Derek Jeter is in fact a bad fielder. We're going to retire probably before that is available all across the major league. So I think that's one thing, is just dealing with that big data. The second thing is you see the leagues and the teams starting to move into the reporting. MLB.com is very aggressively hiring people. I'm guessing, their video products throwing off so much free cash flow that they can just hire reporters, even if they're not necessarily making money off them yet. So I think that's a trend. And even Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, has talked about starting his own reporting group just to present. He said, why do we need the papers? We can report this to our audience now through our website and elsewhere. So I think the teams and the leagues are going to, I think they're probably going to move more into that role as time goes on.
Yeah, I guess specifically answer Andy's question, I would hope that in 10 years, when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you would do is go to Fangraphs.com. And then when you need to answer a question during the day, you would go to Fangraphs.com. And that would kind of be the trend. That might be a pipe dream, but that's what I'm hoping for personally. But I do think you've made some really good points. I think the trend that I've seen over the last decade that I don't think is going to slow down anytime soon is the democratization of ideas. I think 10 years ago, if any of us had a really good idea about baseball, our outlook was to call the local sports radio station, talk for 7 seconds, and get hung up on it. That was really how you tried to get your idea out there. Or you write a letter to the editor, I guess, and they might publish it, and that would be the end of it. Nowadays, with Twitter and so every access you have, if you have a good idea, regardless of what your name is, regardless of your credentials, if you have a good idea, you can disperse it to a large amount of people, and you can become an expert on a subject matter very quickly. I mean, we have a community blog on Fangraphs, so it's just people who read our site, and they go in, they write up some stuff. If we like it, we will publish on our big Fangraphs, and 50,000 people will see it that day. And they can get their idea out very quickly. I think that is never going to go away, and it's only going to continue to increase to where we're going to get away from an expert's mentality to more of a judging ideas on their merits rather than the merits of who said them. I personally think that's a great thing. I think that if someone has a great idea, we want to be able to have that idea in the public sector rather than having to pay your dues, climb the ladder. In 15 years, when you've established yourself with a reputation of a reliable source, then we'll listen to you. I think the idea is to get information, get good opinions, get good analysis. And I think the Pandora's box has been opened to where, as we go forward, the tools are only going to make it easier for Joe Smith in Pittsburgh to be the pirates expert on the internet. Where if you need to know something, it has become established that he knows more about pirates than anyone else on earth. And who knows, maybe there'll be a direct feed to his house, you just call Joe Smith and be like, hey man, I need to know something about the pirates. I mean, who knows where we're going to go, but I do think that there is a significant push towards democratizing ideas and getting away from the needing to go to a certain select few of people for answers. I think it'll be interesting to see how technology is tailored to helping everyone get their ideas out and spread them around.
Let me pick up on something you just said. Because it seemed to me that one of the trends we might see in all of this is that there's a certain amount of segmentation here. Each of you guys does different things. Okay? Why don't you go into the database business so your people don't have to go to another site? John, why don't you go into the analysis business? Russ, why don't you go into the history business? Bill, why don't you pull all this together with your corporate experience so we only have to go to one site for everything?
Well, I think we are in the database business. I mean, we have different numbers than Sean has. I think we have complementary sites. We have a lot of respect for Baseball Reference. I hope he has some respect for Fangraphs. But I do think what we're trying to do is really provide information to people about absolutely anything baseball related. So we have a section of Fangraphs called Not Graphs that is as far from analysis as you can possibly get, but it's humorous and it's baseball related and it's interesting. We have a big database with things like O-swing percentage and these esoteric stats that only a very few people are going to be interested in. I'll write a piece about how Jared Gervin's pitch last night is new two-seam fastball. We are really trying to appeal to baseball as a whole and kind of get away from the niche of just being statistical analysts who just like their formulas and mother's basement. I mean, I don't live in my mother's basement anymore. I haven't lived for a really long time. So I think we are trying to present ourselves as a hub for anyone interested in baseball can get something from Fangraphs. Someone like Bill wants to offer us $40 million to be part of their hub. I think we'll say yes right now. So.
I'll let you know.
Okay. I guess from my perspective, I'm kind of lazy. I always thought content is a lot of hard work, so kind of a treadmill, having to write a news story every day and having to analyze things every day. So I have created a new feature on Baseball Reference, and it's there in perpetuity for everyone to see. So it's on my part, it's somewhat laziness, I guess. I think more generally, I with apologies to Russ, I think newspapers. I'm not sure how much of a role newspapers are going to play in the future. I think. With the internet flattening everything, making everything available from anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world, I think you're probably going to see more niches because I have a passion for baseball stats. I love doing that. I like to think I'm good at it. And I'm going to have probably an advantage over the LA Times, maybe not Bloomberg, but over the LA Times at least, in producing that content. So that's where we've chosen to focus and put all of our resources into.
You should note that the number 3 app on my iPhone is baseballreference.com, so he's got a fan on the table. This is a sermon that I give to our staff on an almost weekly basis, is that we do, as the media landscape has gotten more crowded, and you're right, the information world is going much deeper and niche, and the barriers to entry have all been vanished, is that we have to stake out some turf. As I mentioned earlier, Dodgers, Angels is an obvious turf for us. I wouldn't dream nor would I want to compete with you on a statistical basis. But conversely, if people want to know what's going on in the locker rooms or injury reports or love them or hate them, we've got some really interesting columnists who are always fascinating to read that you can't find anyplace else. Those are the places where we want to stake out our niche. I don't talk much about the newspaper anymore as a property. We talk more about our newsroom because, again, it's more about reaching readers at the point that they consume information. But just by way of information, our web traffic has quadrupled over the last 4 years, as have most major news organizations that have invested any serious money in it. But one-third of the traffic that comes to latimes.com every month goes to our sports section. It is the number one attraction and driver of things to the site, and of that, our baseball Dodgers are second only to the Lakers in that interest. And what we're trying to do is in that space is to bring features and things to the. If you're going to come to us, we've got a lot of friends around the country who I know read the site every day because they want to know what happened to the game last night if they didn't stay past their bedtimes to check the scores, whatever. They'll read the game score the notes box and check the box score, what have you. So what we're trying to do is when most people come to our site, we want to catch them with more information that we can deliver that would be unique. There are probably certain statistical places that we can do. We would be able to do as well as baseball reference, but we can maybe satisfy some percentage of the fan interest in that space that might keep them from going to baseball reference for more.
I think your question is really interesting because I think it actually gets to a real tension that you see across many industries and certainly the media between the benefits of consolidation and efficiency and one-stop shopping versus the benefits of multiple sources of competition. And I actually think one of the great things about our country is that we don't really like having a single source, as efficient as it might be. We don't think it should just be coming from one place. And I bet even if Bloomberg pulled all this stuff together to make it easy for you, Andy, at the end of the day, you said, well, wait a minute, how come Bloomberg knows everything? So, I certainly saw this when we introduced the Yellow Line Sport Vision. And we were kind of signing up Fox and ESPN and ABC and so forth. And there was one other company that was trying to do it as well. And they got the deal with CBS. And I was very surprised. The guy from CBS said to me, I'm not saying they do it better. In fact, I'm not sure they do it better, but I don't think it's good for our industry if there's only one company doing this. And he supported that other company purely for that reason. So I think that there's a big tradition, which is a great tradition, of having multiple sources, and it is being only accelerated by the fact that barriers to entry are low, and we have all of these media platforms by which people can introduce new ideas and can speak to the public. However, there are also benefits to efficiency and consolidation. In fact, Bloomberg's team product, which we now have 19 of the major league teams under contract for our professional product, which has an all-in-one consolidated system of scouting and news and data analysis and video and so forth, it provides tremendous efficiencies for the clubs where previously they've had to get sort of each of these things from different sources or do it themselves. So there's a tremendous benefit to that. So in certain contexts, it's really the right way to go. But I do think that in terms of broader media, it's not likely to happen. The only caveat is that, and this sort of gets to what Dave was talking about a minute ago, having this gigantic cacophony of voices out there with everybody wanting to get their idea out. There are some great ideas in there, but they can get lost if you don't have a good editor or a good system for being able to find these thousand, offers, the three or four that really have some tremendous merit. And so no matter how broad it gets, there's always going to be a role for expertise, for experience, and for editing in order to make sure that we are able to identify those things that have lasting value.
Ask one last question, and then we'll put it on the floor. Pick up on something that Russ said. Dave, I know you've written about this in the past. Getting statistical information on the web is pretty easy. You can find the box scores. We could now, thanks to Retrosheet and Sean, we can find accurate statistics and box scores, decades and decades and decades back. What we often come up short on is what I guess I would call news. Those of us here in LA, for example, have a little divorce issue that we are very interested in and concerned about, and only shows up indirectly in box scores. I suspect a lot of people in this room like me will read a box score late in the evening or in the morning and say, why didn't my player X play yesterday? And, it's because he had a little hammy issue and will be back in tomorrow. Maybe he hasn't been transacted yet, but he's been designated for assignment because the manager can't stand it. We're getting all of that information just about from newspapers. When I look at ESPN.com, when I look at Fox and drill down into their team sites looking for information like that, I found out that they're picking up news stories from newspapers, which are an endangered species. I'm just reading an article in the local paper here yesterday that the local paper here in Long Beach may be about to die. Newspapers like the Times are making heroic efforts to quit being a paper product and instead be a news product across a lot of mediums. But that's a difficult transition. It's been very difficult for a lot of papers. So I guess the question I'm throwing back at you guys, and Dave, as I said, you've expressed concern about this on Fangraphs several times. Where are we going to get that kind of information as newspapers perhaps disappear? Perhaps.
Well, I think to me one of the interesting things is that I think we certainly need information. We need access to that kind of knowledge that you can't get from just looking at a number. But I guess the thing that I've struggled with is, does that need to come from an objective reporter? And that's kind of been the system that's been set up in America for the last 100 or so years. Somebody with no affiliation with the organization would go in and act as an outside source to gather this information and report it with credibility. I think over the last 10, 15 years, not just in sports, but in politics and all walks of life, objectivity has become devalued. I don't think people so much care so much about whether the person has a preconceived idea of the news that they are reporting. They just want to be fair and balanced. I think in my case, a lot of people understand that I root for the sixth best organization in baseball, the Seattle Mariners. They don't necessarily devalue what I have to say in every circumstance. Maybe in some circumstances they do. But they're still willing to listen to me talk about the Mariners, even though they realize that I have an alliance and I have a rooting interest in their success. I do think that objectivity has become less important for people to receive information. So I will wonder if we need reporters who are objective to go gather that information, or if we can just follow Logan Morrison on Twitter, and he says, I'm hurt, I'm not playing today. He's not an objective source, but he can still provide us that information. Or the Major League teams, as Sean noted, they hire their own beat writers. There is questions about their objectivity since they receive paychecks from the teams, but they can tell you who's in the lineup that day. They can tell you who's sick. They can tell you who got traded. They can get quotes from the general manager. They can perform a lot of functions of a traditional beat writer, even if their objectivity is in question. To me, I'm interested to see how much people demand objectivity from their reporters in the future.
Russ, why don't you respond to
that? I think that's a self-answering question. The best example would be the divorce. Are you going to believe how MLB.com covers their beliefs in negotiations from the courts, or are we going to be a more reliable source of that information?
All right.
think there is likely to be a gap, at least maybe not in LA, but in some markets there's going to be a gap. I mean, in Philadelphia, the papers have gone through a very trying time the last 3 or 4 years. And I see, you know, sites like mine as a site that aggregates information and the David site adds analysis. But I do think there's going to be some upset in where the reporting actually comes from. And, you know, I see sites like MLB Trade Rumors or, you know, Baseball Think Factory. They're aggregating content, and usually it's from newspapers. And if those newspapers go away, there's going to be a lack of, there's probably an opportunity there, actually. I always wonder why the sporting news, actually, model hasn't come back for baseball. Just put 30 writers in each city, and off you go. But, you know, I think something's going to happen in the next 10 years. It's, you know, none of us knows what it's going to be.
I would just add that I think you put your finger on a very serious problem we have, which is that the economic model that supported objective media and journalism is eroded. And you even have, in the investigative journalism sphere, a bunch of nonprofits popping up where people are funding investigative journalism because it's the only way to make it pay, because newspapers can't afford to underwrite that kind of thing. In the sports world, you do have that potential of, you know, not having a sort of source. And I guess I would really not agree with what Dave said. I mean, I think Russ used a really sort of nice tame example, but imagine if the only source we had for, you know, our news is, you know, Anthony Weiner saying that he was hacked, as opposed to real journalists like digging it out and finding out that that was not actually what happened. I mean, you can't really just accept the source, somebody saying, I'm injured, I'm not playing. Maybe he's not injured, maybe he's a drug addict. Who knows? But I mean, the point is, there's a reason why you have to have real media. Now, there's also a place for what Dave's describing, which is various points of view. Often, those uncover a lot of interesting insights and perspectives. But if you don't have both, you're really going to have a problem, because if all you have are these different perspectives, you're going to have to start triangulating and trying to figure out what's really true, because everybody who's writing and reporting has a different agenda. So this is a real dilemma. I mean, it's not something that's going to be solved easily, but I do think that the American public, sports fans, and generally people who are consuming news, have a real fairness kind of metric or barometer, and they're going to insist that there be a model that allows them to get information in a way that's reliable. But I think it's still to be, you know, determined how that's going to happen.
Thank you. If you could, anybody with a question, start lining up the mic, we'll take the door. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Hi, just a couple things. One, I have compared to the LA Times, and Bill Shakin, your reporter on the Voice Matter, is the number one person on that story, and he's doing great. Great job, and I would say to anyone really about interested about what's going on a day-to-day basis, just follow the writers on Twitter, because usually we can tell the current information what's happening with the teams right away. But getting to the point you just talked about the having reports embedded, when I talked to Josh Rarovich a couple of years ago, after the Daily News, I think, had cut back and stopped sending out reporters to cover the Dodgers, one thing he did really think about, and they have done, is adding in other people like bloggers or other people to come in and sit and have access to the team and start credentialing them, because he only had the LA Times and Ken Gernick, the MLB.com person. So, but then there's the question I have is that there's this concern is that when you have people from coming from the outside, they're not reporters in general, now they're inside. Do you think that people think that now, oh my God, they're corrupted? What do people think? Like now, you weren't part of traditional journalism. You maybe laughed at traditional journalism, but now they may start opening up their doors to you because they see that the other traditional media markets aren't there anymore.
I guess I'm probably the least traditional media guy up here, with all respect to Sean. I will say that I do think that there's an interesting dynamic there. Last year, I tried to go to the All-Star game in Anaheim. Applied for a credential through Fangraphs and was denied. So then I called my editors at the Wall Street Journal, where I freelance, and they said, sure. And so I was able to get a credential through a major media company. Same person, just I had to get it through the Wall Street Journal instead of the Fangraphs. So there's obviously still a resistance to letting bloggers and so-called non-traditional journalist in. But I tried to make sure that I maintained myself fairly well while covering the All-Star game. And I'm friendly with a lot of reporters and traditional media people. You know, didn't embarrass myself too badly, I didn't think. And I also don't think that it necessarily affected my credibility to actually be at the All-Star game. I mean, I went and talked to Jared Weaver about why he was adding so many more strikeouts than he had previously. And I think I was able to ask some questions that a beat writer might not ask, coming from a perspective of someone who understands pitch effects analysis and can talk to him about platoon splits and pitch types. I do think that I was able to ask some questions that were somewhat interesting. Now, because he's Jared Weaver, he did not provide interesting answers to those questions. In fact, he had absolutely no idea why his strikeout rate went up, which I found hilarious. But I do think that there is an area where people who maybe have a different perspective on the game and a different perspective on the numbers could come in and ask interesting questions of the athletes. But I do think the teams need to be very careful about who they let open the doors to. I don't think that everyone who writes for Bleacher Report should get a media credential. That's just me. But I do think that there's going to be a shift, and the teams will become more open to giving credentials to people who might not have gone to journalism school or might not work for a newspaper. And those people, I do think, will be able to add value in interesting ways.
Yeah, I'm going to try to turn this into sort of one question because I have a few notes here. Mostly in the context of information access, it does strike me that there's sort of two extremes. There's what Sean's doing, which is number crunching and database. You can write a computer program and it's reproducible, and you know, one computer versus another is going to produce the same information. I call that purely objective. On the other hand, something like Bleacher Report or maybe the comment section on something, highly subjective, and you know, like things like, say, cutting out all the profanity or whatever, you know, you're figuring out how to separate the wheat from the chaff. What I wonder about has to do with information access in general, particularly as we're going to this very computerized, you know, web system, and it's everything from, you know, discussion management and how do you get, you know, meaningful information out of that to, I've had problems with what I would consider objective information. I remember going to a Rockies game where I couldn't, I thought it might be the longest 9-inning game they played. I could not find that online. I ultimately had to resort to the paper media guide, and it was at the top of the list in there. It was easy to find, and I'm thinking, how can I not find this online when the paper media guide has it, you know, and then that somehow that info didn't get transferred. The other thing that I run into, because I basically get all my info online for baseball, MLB.tv does not let me watch my Rockies games in Colorado. It doesn't let anybody watch their Rockies games locally, and they're blacked out. Now, just because I do not own a television and I do not get cable, I have to go to the local sports bar or a friend's house to watch a baseball game. I think that is a dumb move, personally, for a digitally moving world. You know, I am paying $100 or whatever they're charging me outrageously so that I get to watch the games here, but not in Colorado. I'd love to hear you guys speak to how you think information access, you know, could be improved, how you think it's going to change, particularly maybe on the television side, because I miss watching the Rockies. So, anyway.
Well, there are a couple of MLB employees here, but I won't point them out, so. You should have filed a blog, because we could add that to one of the play index features pretty easily. I think data access, we obviously try to make as much data available as possible. We do have one for paid feature that gets some use. A lot of teams use that, and other, especially media people use that. I'm always trying to push more data out there as much as possible. And my favorite emails are, I get an email from some man or woman who says, well, I have an interest in 1950s, so I have digitized all of the salaries from the 1950s. I mean, and these people like fall out of the sky, and I thank my lucky stars that they seek us out. So I think going forward, we just launched a mobile site that's actually on weekends. It's getting like fifth to a fourth of all of our traffic is via the mobile site, and I'm sure we're getting football ready to go on the mobile site as well, and that'll probably be much bigger on the weekends. So So I think data is only going to be more available. The internet is all about rooting around barriers, and you know, if you try to put up a wall, newspapers bounce when they try to charge you around, and people just find it elsewhere. They decide, well, it's not really worth it. And I feel for them. If I could charge a nickel for every 100 pages people use on Baseball Reference, I would find it flowing here in my chat. But you know, it's just not possible. People expect access, and generally that's what they're going to get, because somebody's going to move around.
And I would just add a couple things. You know, at Bloomberg, we also really are very focused on data and analytics and core technology. But there's a place for both the subjective and the objective. And our approach has been to be very much about the facts and about the analytics. On the video side, I think that the day will come when the problem you're experiencing will go away. It's inevitable. Just as the music industry couldn't force people to buy $14.99 albums forever when all they wanted to hear was one song, technology made that disappear. It was a huge disruptive force in the music industry. And you can see in the book industry the same sort of disruptive activity happening where people are, able to get a device. I don't know how many of you have Kindles or, use an iPad to download books, but, think about it. That's the first iteration. This is the most primitive digital book reader. I mean, 10 years from now, it'll be the most user-friendly device ever, and you wonder why you're all plugged around a book, okay? And all the economics of the industry are going to change. But with video, there are a whole slew of rights issues that affect how you get access to local games, whether it's via the internet or television. But as more and more over-the-top solutions happen, and you have HD phone cameras where people will distribute video, and it'll be widespread, it'll be like the Napster of video, eventually the people who have the responsibility will come up with a solution that gets everybody access in a solid way. And Major League Baseball, and particularly Major League Baseball Advanced Media, deserves a lot of credit for having really pushed the envelope. They've done tremendously innovative things. We partner with them on a lot of fronts. So they're simply following the rules that exist today with respect to rights. They don't really have an option. But I think they're more likely to be part of the solution because they're interested in really delivering to the public and pushing out. I'll tell you, other organizations can also help with finding a solution. I mean, Saber itself is a great organization because it has the ability to articulate the kinds of concerns of baseball fans. And I think that working through, this type of organization and others, we can sort of move the bar in a lot of different areas. I mean, Bloomberg, we're really eager to work with a lot of the new things that Saber is doing. I know that there's conference planned in Arizona next March that we are looking forward to working with Saber on. We think it's a really great idea. And so all these things have the ability to influence people who, can then actually make change.
I own a PC, I own an iPhone. Not sure how much further than that I'm gonna get. I don't have a Kindle. I still like hard copy. I'd be real unhappy if the New York Times and LA Times went away. My question is how do you see the distribution of your revenues evolving and changing over the next 10 years that we're talking about?
Is that question directed to anybody about the government?
I hate this question. The big issue in our business is that our as I indicated earlier, our audience has never been greater than any point in our history. We've got 20 million unique visitors that come to LATimes.com every month from all over the world in places we could never deliver the newspaper. And we are unfortunately not alone in this respect. Our business hasn't yet figured out how to monetize that readership growth in the same way that we did for 129 years on the print side. And so right now, the vast majority high 80s, low 90% of our revenue still comes from the newspaper, which has an audience that is 1/20th the size of our online effort. And that's an improvement over 5 years ago, but it's not happening at a fast enough rate to offset the declines that we've seen in print. So we're working on a number of initiatives. Our best one I can't talk about yet, but we'll start to hear about it in the fall, that we think is a digital play that will help us reverse that trend and be able to keep the LA Times newsroom going for another 129 years.
I don't think anybody really has an answer for you. I mean, within industry, and all of the titans of industry are trying to figure out how to deal with these economic models and this change. And, you know, I know even in the shortest terms, we at Bloomberg have a fantasy baseball product that we introduced last year, and we really accelerated it this year. We expected to have some increase in our mobile sales versus our online sales. Our mobile sales shot up like this, way beyond what we anticipated. Our online sales were about what we expected. Mobile just went through the roof. So, you know, everybody's trying to get their arms around these shifting models. And as Russ was saying, the problem is that the advertising dollars aren't following the content in the internet the way that a model might have anticipated with the number of people, traffic, customers that are there. And part of the reason for that is in the early days of the internet, everybody gave everything away for free and got people to expect that things were going to be free and even without advertising, all this stuff. So, you know, Google gets all the money for advertising on the internet because it's all being driven that way. These things are going to have to get sorted out, but it's going to take some time and there's going to be some real disruptions that happen.
My question is a follow-up on the one that you just heard, which is newspapers have been giving away free content for the past 10, 12 years. Everybody's used to that as a platform, so you can't unring the bell. So that being the case, everyone's used to and expecting free content. How do you monetize that? How do you start charging your readers to get that content now over the internet as a way to monetize it? Is that the only way for newspapers to stay relevant, stay in business, and attract a bigger audience?
I don't think it's the only way. We were the first major newsroom to charge for online content back in 2003, and we put all of our entertainment coverage online. And the traffic to that went straight to zero in a matter of weeks. We then got out of business in the New York Times. They're smarter than everybody else. They followed us in 2005 and put all their editorial opinion and columnists behind that, and had the same experience. So now you had two major news operations that had that same experience. So what is clear is that we have to figure out how to get people to pay. When you guys mentioned earlier, the production and creation of news is very labor intensive and very expensive. And you know, traveling with a major league sports team all year, the budgets for our baseball coverage are astronomical compared to a lot of the other things that we do in the news. And we continue to do them because the reader base for that is really large, and that's not something we ever want to stop doing. But we do have to figure out a way to get people to help us figure out to pay for the production of that important information so that it doesn't disappear. And like I say, we have a couple of initiatives underway that I can't really talk about right now, but there's been a lot written in recent weeks about tablets, not just the iPad, but there are a bunch of other tablet products that are coming out that would appear to create some opportunities for some more revenue potential in that space, and that's where a lot of the folks that are in our shoes are looking for.
I do want to point out, too, that I do think that there's capitalism will figure this out to some extent. I mean, I believe Mark Zuckerman, I believe his name is, was a Washington Nationals beat writer who got laid off. And when he got laid off by the Washington Times, I believe, they were facing the issue of the only beat writer going to spring training for the Nationals last year was the MLB.com beat writer. And Nationals fans said, "We think this is terrible," and they gave the guy like $20,000 to send him to spring training. And he put up a little note that said, "Support me going to Florida," and he got in like 4 days. And so I do think, like, if there is demand for a beat writer to travel around the country and get teams for it, I'm not sure what the model will look like, but some guy might just put up a thing on it that says, "Give me $100,000 to follow a team around the country," and he might get it. I mean, I just think we don't know what the demand level is for that kind of information, whether the market will figure it out.
I mean, I think a lot of the previous revenues that a lot of these media companies were seeing were because they were monopolies. I mean, there was only one newspaper in a city, and if you wanted to advertise in that city, you went to that newspaper and they advertised it. And now on the internet, that's no longer the case. So they're not going to see the monopoly profits that or revenues that they saw before. I mean, we struggle. We're largely an ad-based model, and I mean, my foremost focus is always speed and ease of use on the site, and I know that ads undermine that. I mean, I get emails, you know, probably three times a week, somebody complaining about an ad that blocked the page, and it's a difficult issue that you have to deal with. Not even, I mean, just a matter of just the ads working the way they're supposed to be. So I'm hopeful that something will happen. I think what Fangraphs does, you know, with their event tonight and other revenue models along those lines, I think you're going to have to see more diversification of what you're doing rather than just personal ads, and that's it.
Staying on the economics thing, this is scary. For an organization that's median age is 59, I'm getting a flashback to 1987 when I used to go to technology venture capital conferences. And I used to hear, it's in the works, but I can't talk about it. And I used to hear, we've got some ideas. And I think the other problem is that Scott Boras this morning did us a disservice because he focused everything on revenue and very little on profit or valuation. So here's my question. Why would I want to be a part of the Fangraph IPO?
Well, I can tell you we don't have an IPO plan.
The SEC may not want to have you say that.
Okay, well, hopefully there's no one from the SEC here. I will say that I do think that like Fangraphs and sites like Baseball Reference, we are providing a service where the value, I mean, the cost for you to visit Fangraphs.com is zero. I think the value you will get from visiting Fangraphs.com is greater than zero. So I do think we are providing pretty good value for the dollar. And we are offering people ways to help keep us in business. Obviously, we need to make enough money to pay my salary. I mean, that's my main concern, really. But I think that people are willing to provide the economics to keep things in around what they want. I think we've seen that with many technologies over the years. If people want something bad enough, they will make sure to find it. It doesn't go away. So I think that's true with traveling beat writers. I think that's true with baseballreference.com. Sean had a great idea of paying sponsorships. I think Jose Batista's paid sponsorship is like $8 million right now. So something very pricey. But there's ways where people will say, you know what, this thing has value to me, and I will give you money to keep you from going away. If you can come up with some creative ways to make it feel like they're not just giving us their money for nothing, that's great. But I do think that as long as there's a value add from a site like ours, or from John's, or from the LA Times, people will part with their money to keep that site in business.
Chris, just a moment. We've only got 4 minutes left, so I don't know how many people are going to get to it. Chris, I'm going to talk to you. Oh, you are? Okay.
There's no questions now, guys. First, thanks for the panel. It's really a panel. And I really think that the Fangraphs represents a lot about the mission statement for SABRE. It encourages research, disseminates information about baseball. It's exactly what this organization is about. So thanks, Dave. Baseball Think Factory, Baseball References Blog does it. And they do it in a very open forum. Newspapers and Bloomberg Sports, while they also do those things, Dave's and Think Factory are open to anybody. Put all your eyes out there, and not just at the bottom of an article. So it's a very useful way to go and how the future will go. But one of the questions that came up earlier is, the Sporting News record book is one of the greatest things ever. I have a whole bunch of them. Sean's got a collection of books that would make your head spin. How do we get back to publishing those? Whether it's as an e-book, Rob Niner does e-books that are really good. Steve Treeter just wrote a great one on the Crossroads about third base, but can we at least see about getting record books, that are, quick? My daughter can quiz me as I drive.
The Sporting News has gone in a different direction than them. I think everybody here knows them. I mean, I own probably 60 baseball guides and 55 registers and some number of record books as well. So thankfully I'm in office now, so they're no longer cluttering up my house. I don't know, Chris. I don't know that maybe someday we'll... I don't know if it makes sense for me personally to put that together, that there's a monetary reward for doing that as opposed to, you know, doing something else. So it's you know, it's probably something I think that would be a great idea for Sabre to put together. That's easy for me to say, but that's just one idea.
Who will you know?
I'm very cordial with Sabre, and you know, we get a lot of our data from Sabre, so I'm always happy to help.
I think this is going to have to be the last question.
Okay, this is pretty quick.
Okay.
I love newspapers. I just want a prediction from each four of you. You can just give me one or maybe two number answers. When do you predict, and you can't pass, when do you predict how many years from now there will be no hard copy newspaper and there will be no hard copy books for sale? Go from left to right if you're top left to right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Bloomberg got first.
You know, we're so digital at our company.
No, you got one or two.
Oh, you just gave me numbers.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so we're some digital art company, and when we delivered our product to the teams, we thought everybody used computers. We forgot to put a print button on there.
Oh.
They couldn't print out the reports and give them to the coaches and the managers and so forth, so we had to, like, put print. So that's not digital. You know, I think it's going to happen one day. I think it'll take a while, but 25 years from now, there's no reason why you're cutting down trees to create paper. Everybody's going to have digital things that are going to be... They're going to make a Kindle look like a Model T. It'll be so easy and so comfortable that, and the generation coming up behind, you know, not Dave, but most of us, they're going to feel like it's totally natural. And I love newspapers too, but you know what? World changes.
That's so sad.
Okay. Looking around the room, I will predict that most of us will be dead before that happens.
I guess I would say for major daily newspapers like the Times or the New York Times or Philly Inquirer, I would say 2018. So is that 7 years? And then for books, I don't think I would be surprised if those ever actually completely go away. But I would say major publishing maybe, you know, 2025, something like that.
Okay.
I guess it's kind of hilarious that the guy who has no vested interest in print has the longest term outlook for this. I think we're going to have newspapers for 30, 40 years, maybe not as many as we have now, but I would say I can't see the New York Times going away before I... I think even in print, I think the New York Times is going to be around, the Wall Street Journal is going to be around, and books, I think I'll be dead before those go away, so... I hope that's a long time from now.